your thinking on some higher ed matters might differ from what you hear a lot, for example, on demography. What we often hear sort of demography is the destiny of higher education.
Yeah, I think that's a demography's destiny has some merit as a broad statement about the fate of an economy. That doesn't mean that it's not unimportant when I say this, but to say demography's destiny implies some things that I think are negative and not necessarily accurate. It implies that if we keep having a large number of immigrant population or Latin American Hispanic population, that over time, because they're on average low income producers, that will pull down the personal income or the income of the state, make us poorer. If everything stays the same, there's always a qualifier, but almost nobody stops there. In fact, that's just not true by itself. There are things that are not going to be the same, and in the case of Texas, it makes us think too negatively, and it also implies that we should do some things to educate people to get their income up and do it faster. It tends to put a burden on us to do something about educating those poor people, and I don't like that attitude. I think there's something a little off based on that. In actual fact, there's a good case history. Texas in the last dozen years has had an increase in that population of people, and you would ordinarily say the demography should imply lower everything and poor growth, and so far in this dozen years, Texas has had an extraordinarily favorable growth rate. Its income relative to the country has grown. We're gaining on them. We have a large number of our population that are high income producers and highly educated that tend to pull up the whole economy and make opportunities available for everybody, including some of the people that come from lower educated places. And what that does, it allows a lot of people, including people with early, when they start here with low education, to grow and have opportunities, and that's a very positive economic environment. And then besides that, the demography itself, there are other factors that are at least as important and maybe more important over time. And if you want me to go into that, I can do that.
Yeah, maybe if you could briefly, if not demography, what are...
Well, in addition to, then you would say, let's just say geography. In other words, a state like Texas has huge natural resources, has a moderate climate, the Gulf of Mexico, great river system. It's a central location relative to emerging and developed markets, centrally located to the Americas, kind of right in the middle of a huge population center. It's got large and productive land areas for agriculture, for development. It's got large quantities of minerals and other natural resources. And we can expand in that kind of environment. It has, frankly, alternative sources of energy like sun, wind, and biomass. Plus, we have our own energy system within the state. So geography itself has a big advantage if we manage those resources right. That's maybe as important as anything we do. Then public policies make a huge difference. You can see that in comparison to, say, us in California and other big states, especially on taxes, public spending, and regulation. They're always key determinants of economic prosperity. And we have ample evidence and wide agreement that Texas has been a national leader in adopting those policies in areas that produce economically for its citizens. That's a very powerful statement. And I think the world now agrees with that, that we, there's so much of that. We win an award year after year for an economic or business climate compared to almost any place in America. And then, of course, you have that's part of that is the environment in general, the cultural or business environment that attracts people that know they have an open chance here to do almost anything they're capable of doing.
And you mentioned California, which is, Texas likes to compare itself to California. One of the current things is this Tier 1 university sort of battle to increase the number of Tier 1 universities in Texas because we have – we like to say we have three, and people like to say California has nine. Is that a worthwhile effort to be engaged in?
Yeah, actually, I have to say the leadership in the legislature, like Senator Zaffarini and Representative Branch and their and predecessors to them and people at the Higher Ed Coordinating Board, they're very supportive of higher education. And so if they have a policy to build the top-tier universities, I think it's sound to want to do that. On the other hand, what you said, the argument for doing it that somebody has nine and we have three, it's just not a good argument for all kinds of reasons. But one of them is it's not even a correct ratio. There are, Rice may be a top-tier university as a liberal arts college or something in the U.S. News and World Report, but it's not a great research university in any normal sense of the word. We have a number of institutions in Texas besides A&M and UT Austin that are huge, famous, world-famous research organizations, and we should count them. There are medical schools like UT Health Science Center in Houston or in San Antonio, or MD Anderson, the number one cancer center in the world, or Southwestern. They bring, each one of those bring in hundreds of millions of dollars, and actually a total of over $1 billion, maybe $2 billion in research dollars. And if you count A&M and UT Austin in the combination, I'm sure it adds up to over $3 billion. It makes us number three in the country in academic research. And most universities are considered top research universities have a medical school. And in fact, California probably has only four top academic schools in the top 50 research category when you look at the research dollars, not some kind of U.S. News and World Report ranking. So we have two big ones, and they have four. Our two big ones make up almost four California ones, because our student population is 45,000 and 50,000, where theirs probably is close to the 30,000. And relative to the size of our state, their population is 50% bigger, their economy is 50% bigger. So us having two very large academic institutions that are top-tier research, that's pretty good compared to California already. They do a pretty good job with dollars. They at California, and they have some private institutions like Stanford and USC that are very, very strong. But public policy can't do anything about that. Compared to the public universities in California, Texas has a very strong position. It probably needs more, but it doesn't mean that it's weak. And if we imply that somehow we're weak but somebody else is strong, when in actual fact it's just the opposite, that's a really bad strategic position, and it sends a signal to other people that somehow we're beggars or something. We should be pounding on our, think of us as Texans, we should be pounding on our chest and saying we're great, we're a research powerhouse. If you look at commercial research and development, which is many, many times bigger than academic research spending, Texas is ranked number fifth. And that's a very, very strong position. If you look at biosciences, all the life sciences, agriculture, plants, people, Texas is probably the second largest in the sense of employment and growth and things like that. And we have a very, very strong growth potential in centers like Austin, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio. So we have a great, great research community in Texas, and we should talk about it, not say how weak we are compared to California or somebody else. And while we're talking about it, California seems to be falling off into the Pacific while Texas is thriving. So if it was true they had 9 versus 3, you might say, so what?
But surely there are, one thing that I know that you've always been a champion of, especially on the public ed side, is accountability. And of course, you helped create the TOS test. Sort of, what has that brought to the education world?
Well, I actually didn't as much create the TOS test. I helped develop a full system of accountability where we had a whole range of things happen. We had a curriculum that was designed with standards at the state level, and we tied the test to those standards, which hadn't been done before. Whatever the test is, that step of making sure that here's what you tell the kids, here's what you want to them, you tell us what you want the kids to learn, but then you test on that instead of just some independent test. We decided to test annually instead of every few years. We put schools as a unit of accountability. We said you have to do certain things at a certain time period or there'll be consequences. And we published a lot of that data. So we made a transformation from spend a lot of money without knowing what you were getting to looking at what we're getting. And I think in the early years, especially over time, that improved the results for everybody. There seems to be evidence, and it closed the gap between kids from low-income families to the rest of the community. It closed the gap, particularly in the early years. It's been fairly stable or stagnant over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, so there probably is more work that needs to be done. There is more work that needs to be done to make that better.
But you hear, you know, some people criticize the standardized testing because teachers have to teach to the test. what do you say to people that...
I'd say it's just wonderful if you're a teacher if you don't have to teach to anything. You just say, whatever I do is going to be okay. It's up to me to decide. When they were doing that, they were turning out kids that didn't have any education. So it's pretty hard to argue that when the clear evidence is that with a decent assessment system, which includes tests, you can have improvement. And almost any place in the world, it would be laughable if you said we're going to measure education without tests. I mean, exams are a constant part of education everywhere, and has always been. I mean, the higher ed community are the biggest testers of all. If you want to get into some colleges, you have to score on standardized tests beyond a certain number. If you want to get into medical school, you have to do certain things on the MCAT, or law school on the LSAT, or graduate school on the GMT or whatever it is. And so higher ed uses tests all the time, standardized tests. So why wouldn't it be correct to use them in, you know, K through 12 settings? And the answer is you do want teachers to teach the tests if the tests are properly designed and you have the right information on those tests. Why wouldn't you want students to learn what's on those tests? And it's pretty clear that there's plenty of room in the curriculum for teachers that are good to teach what's required on the state standards and have more room to teach other things. It's actually just an argument that's used. Teach the test sounds like the poor teachers don't have any freedom. And to some extent, some freedom's removed, but actually really good teachers can tell you, I want to do that and I can do more. And so I think that's more of a lame excuse not to do it is needed than a valid argument against testing.
You mentioned financial aid earlier, and a lot of people worry about tuition, and you had a large role in the tuition deregulation. And sort of what has that done for the state, and has it made tuition go up to an excessive degree?
Well, I'd say our average tuition in Texas is about for a four-year college is about the same as the national average would be, and the rest of the country is probably going faster. We did a catch-up, going back 5 or 6 years ago from a very, very low base, and by having a rigid set of tuition requirements for all kinds of schools all over the state and for all kinds of programs of any kind, that was actually really inefficient and very, very poor in work. What was happening is we were adding fees to those tuition things quietly and silently without disclosing that to the students. So we were actually raising rates pretty rapidly, although from a low base, you couldn't tell it in dollar terms. There were still big increases for many years. Then every once in a while, the legislature would pop another increase in there without knowing what was needed or talking about it in the context of all the things. And so having tuition flexibility allows the universities, different universities, to charge different amounts for different programs and actually to give incentives for kids to finish sooner by letting them earn 18 hours for the same price they have 12 hours, and that kind of incentive gets them out sooner, and it's cheaper for everybody, the state and for the student, for the family. So there are a lot of benefits for tuition deregulation. It makes some people unhappy because it looks like everybody has to pay more, when in actual fact at UT, we didn't ask families from below average income or students to pay more at all. We put a lid on it. We asked students in the next quartile up to the 75th percentile only to pay part of the increase, and then we asked kids from high-income families only to pay the full increase. And over time, along with increases in financial aid, we made it much more equitable, and we made it easy for families that could afford to pay and wanted to pay because they wanted to go to a good school and they wanted the school to be maintained as a good school, which they couldn't do without some income. And they allowed kids from poorer or less lower income families to still come. There wasn't any limitation. So while it's unpopular because prices are going up and it looks percentage wise like it's a big increase, it's been a savior for the universities. If the state had the money to support more kids with lower tuition or financial aid based on need, that would be okay, but they don't and haven't, period.